SF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded August 12, 2026. Well, Monday's massive earthquake in Western Colombia served as a terrifying reminder to neighboring Venezuelans, still picking up the pieces of the twin quakes they suffered just 7 weeks ago. Countries around the world have pledged support in rescue efforts for Colombia, where hundreds are confirmed dead and more feared under the rubble. Despite the Venezuelan toll exceeding 5,000 persons killed, the United States-led sanctions against the nation remain, if under a temporary reprieve, even as U.S. official representatives and agents of transnational corporations are in country devising methods of shrinking the government of acting President Delcy Rodriguez and dividing the spoils of Donald Trump's invasion. Ricardo Vosch is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the communications collectives Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His latest there is Venezuelan business spokesman says privatizations will boost efficiency, reduce state payroll. Ricardo Vosch in the first half. And there's perhaps no more apt analog for Colombia's current political situation than Monday's deadly earthquake. The new president has as much as promised to tear down all leftist Gustavo Petro's government has built up over the last 4 years. Abelardo de la Espriella promises, too, he will reinstitute war on drugs measures, including the glyphosate fumigado in the countryside. But do his American sponsors really want to recreate the conditions of Colombia's civil war? Dan Kovalik's a lawyer, educator, labor, peace, and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. Dan represented unions whose membership were targeted by Colombia's death squads during the generational conflict there. Dan currently acts as Gustavo Petro's legal representative in the United States. His book titles include No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, and his latest co-authored with Jeremy Kuzmarov, Syria, Anatomy of Regime Change, Dan Kovalik and the New Plan for Colombia in the second half. But first, Ricardo Vosch and a vulture's plunder in Caracas. Welcome back to the program, Ricardo.
Happy to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you, of course. Now, Ricardo, before getting to the planned, efficient dividing of the spoils of Venezuela's public wealth by private interests, how, Ricardo, is the earthquake recovery process there proceeding?
It's faded from the headlines because we've moved past this kind of immediate stage. I mean, of course, first when you could still find survivors, and then, you know, moving the people who lost their homes to these temporary shelters. And now, I mean, some of them are being moved to not so temporary shelters. But I mean, it's going to be a slow process because you don't need reminding, and probably the audience doesn't need reminding. But I mean, this comes at a time when the Venezuelan state is in a weak condition, right? I mean, it's been 10 years of U.S. economic sanctions, and so its ability to respond to a disaster, whether it's, you know, the immediate response or, you know, what comes after, is severely constrained, and even more so because these coercive measures from the United States and its allies remain in place. I mean, it's almost 2 months since the earthquake, and you talk about the gold that's sitting in the United Kingdom or, you know, the bank accounts in the U.S., or even the special drawing rights that the IMF issued during COVID in 2021, if I'm not mistaken. Neither of those funds have been released for, you know, immediate needs here in Venezuela. And so it's very clear, and of course, you can't help but think of Haiti, that this is also being used as preconditions and leverage to impose even further foreign domination over the Venezuelan economy. So the Venezuelan government has promised some housing solutions. I think it's 4,000 this year and up to 10,000 next year. But even that, I mean, there are 25,000 families who lost their houses. And so there are some credit programs, but still, I mean, the purchasing power here is very, very limited. So I don't know how far that can go. And it's also a stark contrast Even during the worst years of the crisis, and even though official figures always require a grain of salt, the Venezuelan Housing Mission was building a lot of homes every year. Maybe, I don't know, even if we doubt the official figures, maybe 100,000 a year. So it just shows how the state's capacity is diminished, and also how this kind of gets rolled into the bigger picture of, the debt restructuring that's on the way, this process of opening the economy at rampant speed to foreign corporations and so on. This is all going to tie in with the earthquake recovery as well.
Well, and how about the monies pledged and promised by the Inter-American Development Bank and the United States?
So yes, the US did pledge, I think, 386 million, and the Inter-Development Bank, I'm not sure, but I mean, for example, the Inter-Development Bank immediately came out and said, "Oh, we are the ones who are going to run the resources. We're not going to deliver them to the Venezuelan government." So again, it's all a pretext to further erode the Venezuelan sovereignty. But even if you think about, the 386 million and so on, that's kind of a drop in the bucket. I mean, the most modest estimates of the damages and reconstruction costs are around 20 billion. So that money goes evaporates, or is rather put to use very quickly, simply in terms of tending to these displaced families or the most immediate repairs you need in terms of infrastructure. When it comes to the long-term recovery and rebuilding this destroyed area, especially in La Guaira, on the coast, it's going to take a lot more resources, and that's what's being still held from Venezuela. And I mean, it's not too it's not you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to imagine that this is being part of negotiations to impose further conditions.
Yeah, the Inter-American Development Bank promised 50 million and then what and more if it was asked, I think was the release that I saw. I'm assuming that they have, unlike Colombia so far, they have asked for it. Is this, I mentioned in the introduction, Ricardo, that this is perhaps triggering for Venezuelans that have gone through these twin earthquakes in late June to see what happened just the other day in Colombia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the earthquakes are still very fresh, and of course, still a very traumatic event. If I'm not mistaken, there were already brigades, Venezuelan brigades, who departed to assist in Colombia. And of course, from the start, Venezuelans and Colombians are very close. I mean, they are essentially the same people, and so you have seen an outpouring of support and solidarity. And hopefully Colombia can also. I mean, it also coincided with this new far-right president taking office. So hopefully it's not as bad at first as it first looked in Colombia.
What is the feelings in Venezuela when they look across the border and see what's going on with the elections in Colombia? Are these mere images of a sort of their own contested elections?
Because of the difficult questions surrounding, I mean, that's putting it very mildly, surrounding the 2024 elections here, Venezuelan officials have been very coy about commenting on other countries' affairs. But at the same time, you now have a foreign policy that's very much aligned and subordinated to U.S. interests. And so it was never going to be the case that the Venezuelan government would openly endorse, the left-wing candidacy of Iván Cepeda. And even if you ask from a very, and I understand this is a bit unreal to be posing this question, but if you ask which victor was more convenient for Venezuela, I'm not exactly sure that it would have been Cepeda, because right now we have this alignment of foreign policy under U.S. interests, and perhaps it will be smoother with De la Espriella. And also there's this issue of armed groups that operate along the border on both sides. And here, I mean, it's a very long story on how the Venezuelan state, because of the blockade and so on, lost its capacity, or had a reduced capacity to operate in those areas. And also how the Colombian recipe of simply trying to kill everyone didn't exactly work. I mean, it didn't even reduce the drug production even after the peace agreement with the FARC. And so now, under this umbrella of this US policy of just bombing everywhere, It might be that the Venezuelan state is just happy to, the Venezuelan government is just happy to cooperate with the US and with Colombia to, you know, come down heavy on these groups that operate along the border and in some cases very, very far inland.
Well, there may be some contention between your country, Venezuela, and Colombia over the mantle of who gets to be called the 51st state of the United States. We in Canada have a stake in this because we've long considered ourselves to be the rightful holders of that title. What do you take of President Trump's announcement of Venezuela being the 51st state?
I think in that regard, Colombia has a head start and a much richer recent tradition in that regard. But I mean, it wasn't the first time that Trump made this stupid provocative comments. But it was significant because just a few days earlier, I'm not sure if you caught this news. So there was this interview that the Iranian foreign minister gave, and it wasn't topic, but he brought it up that, you know, Iran is not like Venezuela where you take out the leader and everybody else just backs down. He said this in an interview, you know, about Iranian resistance against U.S. attacks and so on. And then a few days later, for no reason that I can think of, the Venezuelan foreign ministry summoned the Iranian ambassador to deliver a formal note of protest against, I don't know, disrespectful comments, something to disregard. And then a few days later, Trump posts this picture of the 51st state, and people were asking, well, you know, are you going to summon the U.S. ambassador and deliver a note of protest as well? And no, of course they didn't.
There is in the press, at least in the press that I read, this question of Delcy Rodriguez's alliances and her allegiances. And it seemed like a weird and bizarre thing to do. But Trump went further. He went on to boast about the so-called 48-minute invasion, when saying that, well, we've done really, I'm paraphrasing, but we've done very well by the invasion of Venezuela. In this 48-minute invasion, now to the victor belong the spoils, being, of course, Venezuela's oil industry.
Yeah, I mean, every time that Trump talks about it, the operation keeps getting shorter. I think it was 3 hours the first time, and now it's just 48 minutes. But, I mean, beyond Trump's bluster, of course, he always exaggerates and he talks about billions of barrels when Venezuela produces 1 million barrels a day. But there was, I mean, you have to look at what the other people say about this. And there was a very revealing interview here a couple of weeks ago. I think I included it in one of these reports where Luigi Pizzella, who is, I mean, I'm not sure where to place him. He's a business sector representative that's now very active in drafting some of these government policies. And he said in an interview, I mean, because there was this headline in the Financial Times that the U.S. has received $13 billion in Venezuelan oil revenues, and where has the money gone? And he felt that he could explain it. And he said, you know, he didn't say 13, but $14 billion. First, we have to deduct the cost of, and he called it the military mobilization. And, you know, people were asking, I mean, hang on, what are you saying? Are you saying that Venezuela has to reimburse the U.S. for being bombed? And it didn't get much traction. I think that everyone was just keen to change the subject. But it's also something that Trump has said. I mean, he said, oh, we have paid for the invasion many times over. And maybe it's not many times over, but it's clear that the U.S. is taking a hefty slice out of these revenues.
Yes, if I remember the numbers, it was 4 billion or four something point something billion for the military maneuvers. But then a $7 billion charge for corporate losses and so forth. I just watched this morning Vijay Prashad appearing on Dmitry Lascaris's Reason to Resist, and they featured your article. The Venezuelan business spokesman says privatizations will boost efficiency, reduce state payroll, in the background. And in talking about this, Mr. Prashad said, well, the fears of privatization are just, what he says, are just noise. What's really at stake here are investor laws, investment protection laws that the IMF is expected to deliver to foreign corporations to secure investment in Venezuela. What do you think of that assertion?
Yeah, I think they come together. I'll have to listen. I'm glad that I'm a reference for Laskaris and Prashad, but I have to see what it means in detail. But in one way, you have already seen this because you've had reforms to hydrocarbons and mining legislation, and they very explicitly stated that, you know, whatever contracts are signed are going to be subjected to international arbitration, whether that's the World Bank's International Court for settlement of investor disputes or the International Chamber of Commerce. So, and this was something that Chavez was very vocal about, you know, the idea that if you have a project in Venezuela, it's from start to finish, it's subjected to Venezuelan legislation. It cannot be subjected to any other. And so that has been something that with this whole discourse that investors need confidence and what have you, is now very much at play in any kind of agreement. But it's not like this is separate from privatizations. I mean, it's two sides of the same coin, because when you talk about electricity, which is a very stark example, I mean, this was completely nationalized by Chavez in 2007, because it was understood to be a strategic sector. And so now you're going to be opening, whether it's generation, distribution, or commercialization, you're going to be opening it to the private sector, to foreign corporations. And of course, those agreements are going to be subjected to this investor protection treaties and so on. So I think those two come hand in hand.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ricardo Vosch. Ricardo is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the communication collectives Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at Venezuela Analysis. His latest there is Venezuelan business spokesman says privatizations will boost efficiency, reduce state payroll. Yeah, Luigi Pacella goes on, the focus of your article that I just mentioned. He says, and I'll quote you quoting him, "Our main goal is to create an efficient state, one that retains only strategic assets, while opening them to private capital and technology." A bit of a word salad in my mind, or salada perhaps. What does he mean then? If he's going to protect strategic assets, you must privatize them or make them available to private capital? That seems like a contradiction in my mind.
Yes, I mean, and this is already a kind of a departure from where this commission started. So when Delcy Rodriguez appointed it, I think it was in April, they had four categories. It was strategic assets to remain full state ownership, ones that would be open to what they call strategic alliances, which are essentially concessions, a third group that would be privatized, and a fourth, which assuming nobody would be interested, they would just be liquidated. So what he's saying here is essentially merging groups one and two and saying that even the ones where the state retains ownership are going to be open to the private sector. This means that either they sell a percentage of the shares while retaining a majority, or what I think is more likely, they enter into this, they call them strategic alliances, these concession type deals where you give someone a free run to manage whatever a power plant for 5 years in exchange for, you know, paying some monthly contribution or what have you, or even smaller services contracts and so on. So it's kind of an admission that there's nothing safe from the private sector, so to say.
Well, what we have up here are P3s, private-public partnerships, and how that's worked out. It's a fairly new thing. I'm sure you're aware of it. But it seems to always work out that the public picks up the costs while the private picks up the profits.
Yeah, I mean, this is a recipe that's been tried in lots of places, and they always present it like it's a novel thing that's just been invented. And you have, I mean, even in the United Kingdom, where, I don't know, Tony Blair was the greatest priest of this third way neoliberalism religion, and even there, I mean, it's kind of a widespread acceptance that rail, for example, has to be nationalized again. I mean, there are services that are strategic and don't work under the profit motive, and we're already seeing here with electricity, because you have a crisis now where basically you don't have enough supply for the country. And so most of the country, Caracas and the oil projects, the oil extraction areas are the ones that are spared. But everybody else has, I don't know, maybe 6 hours of blackouts a day or even worse. And of course, that generates a lot of anguish. And so now you say, oh, well, the solution is to bring in the private sector. But again, who has the purchasing power to pay what international costs for electricity every month? I mean, certainly not with these incomes. So that's not really going to be a solution. So then what you may have is some kind of a premium service for people who can pay, and then everybody else gets some subsidized blackouts every day. But what this means is that what's supposed to be a public and universal service ceases to be public and certainly ceases to be universal.
There's been much made of the Israeli visit to Venezuela under the guise of mapping out aid for the post-earthquake redevelopment. Hugo Chavez famously broke relations in 2009 over the CAS-led invasion, one of these many lawn mowing, as the Israelis would have it, operations. How do Venezuelans react, if they do, to seeing this an Israeli delegation in Caracas, and especially one led by the man responsible for the CAS-led invasion of 2000 and or operation of 2009?
We published a piece last week. We called it the Zionist Beachhead in Venezuela. And you're right. I mean, we profiled some of the actors, at least the ones who appeared publicly and were named in reports. And it includes one guy who is a weapons contractor, and, you know, what does he have to do with earthquake assistance or recovery? So the Israeli presence is not visible. I mean, what you saw in the days after the earthquake was that they would go out on the streets and quickly inspect the building, record it, and then get out again. I mean, if they run into any kind of organized movement, I mean, they're going to be challenged. And they either did this quick shoot and run photo ops and so on, or they were within the confines of these official spaces with the NGOs and the Venezuelan government officials. But now, I mean, this is slowly expanding. You now see, for example, these Israeli NGOs giving training to other international or Venezuelan NGOs, even far from Caracas and with nothing to do with the earthquake. And then you saw the recent announcement. I mean, it was in quick succession. First, the foreign minister met with the highest profile Orthodox rabbi here in Venezuela, saying that, you know, the rabbi had requested that Venezuela reestablish diplomatic ties for the protection of the Jewish community here, which, as far as I know, has never been under any kind of threat. And I don't think it's very small to begin with, and I don't think anyone has ever threatened them. But then immediately, 2 days later, there was already a joint announcement. So both the Venezuelan and the Israeli foreign ministries published the exact same statement, translated, saying that they had agreed to continue bilateral technical cooperation, which means, you know, Israeli involvement in the reconstruction, and also reestablish consular services for the citizens of their respective countries. I don't know of any significant Venezuelan presence in Israel. And as I was saying, I mean, the Jewish community, which is not necessarily Israeli, is also very small here. But I mean, it has already caused a lot of outrage and in mobilizations, even though they have like a broader perspective, you know, rejecting the imperialist plunder that we were talking about, rejecting the imperialist control over Venezuelan affairs. This topic is correctly, in my opinion, correctly understood to be deeply involved in, you know, how not just legitimization of Zionism, but also its expansion in Latin America, and how it installs spying services and weapons contractors and so on. So you have seen, and that's always, I mean, even if it's fleeting, it's some relief, you know, the burning of U.S. and Israeli flags. I'm not sure this is going to escalate into any kind of significant challenge against the government, but it's sure to be a kind of a permanent grievance.
Well, I saw a little clip of Hugo Chavez's reaction to the CAS-led atrocity. He was incandescent, outraged, and this is what led to breaking relations with Israel. back in 2009. I can't imagine what he would react to now, witnessing what we've witnessed in these last 2 years, and knowing, I'm sure, that Castled was a step to, amongst many, towards what is a total genocide, an annihilation of the Palestinian people. And yet this mealy-mouthed response from I'm not even sure what to call the Rodriguez government now, but I mean, I can only imagine he'd be today spinning in his grave.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't even have, I mean, of course, Chavez was very principled on this, and he's still respected and revered in other parts of the world for actions such as and speeches such as that one. But you don't have to go that far back. I mean, Maduro in January 2024 publicly endorsed this genocide accusation by South Africa at the International Court of Justice. So even though the Venezuelan government endorsed this idea of a UN brokered two-state solution, which I mean, that would be another discussion. Regardless of how unfeasible it is and how Venezuela remain committed to these kinds of multilateral mechanisms, it still drew Maduro still drew a very significant red line when it came to Palestine and when it came to publicly condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza, the war in Lebanon, the war against Iran. I mean, there are so many episodes in the recent past. And here it's only been 7 months and we've seen a complete 180. I mean, I don't think Delcy Rodriguez has made any mention of Palestine in these months. I mean, even though you continue to see these daily massacres against civilians, when the U.S. and Israel launched the war against Iran in February, the first statement you saw actually condemned, I mean, it vaguely condemned the fact that there was war, and then it condemned explicitly Iran for responding against U.S. bases in the region. And so it's a really complete turnaround in foreign policy, which is very much aligned with U.S. interests all over the world.
Well, and there is some pushback. You have another article up, Leftist Groups Rally Against Imperialist Plundering, and the unveiling or enunciating of the so-called Marrakech Declaration, if my pronunciation on that may be not correct. It seems quite modest to me. If Hugo Chavez is being disremembered, forgotten, memory hold, well then Maduro, I don't know what to call, he is the forgotten man, it seems to me, at least in the press up here. What can you tell us about Nicolas Maduro's condition in the United States right now, and is he still is his name still on the lips of Venezuelans?
No, he has also faded here from discourse. I mean, in the U.S., there's a very committed alliance of solidarity movements who still hold a monthly protest outside the jail where he's being held. But here, I mean, he has slowly the murals and posters of, you know, demanding Maduro's return are being taken down, you know, quietly. And Venezuelan officials have completely dropped it from their discourse. I mean, someone could start a timer of, you know, how many days has it been since Delcy Rodriguez last mentioned Maduro. And it's also very telling. She gave an interview, and when asked about Maduro, she said, oh, he has a right to defend himself. And I'm paraphrasing. I'm confident that he will expose the truth, something like this. But that's not the same as him being the president, because if he is the president, then he's not subjected to whatever laws any other country throws at him. So the Rodriguez government has reached this very damning accommodation with the United States. And I think part of it, that which of course is not going to be publicly admitted, is letting this Maduro trial run its course without publicly demanding his release, which, I mean, would be the starting point for any kind of sovereign definition of a country.
Well, Delcy Rodriguez, the last time we spoke, and we'll have to leave it there, but I mean, that was 6 weeks ago or so. She was lobbying Washington for immunity for herself. Did she get that? Was she granted that immunity from arrest, that she won't be spirited away in the middle of the night as her predecessor was?
I think what we were talking about, I mean, there's one case which is a civil case, so she's not going to be arrested for that. A civil case where some U.S. citizens who were detained here and then they were released in a prisoner exchange for Alex Saab, they basically sued a number of Venezuelan leaders, including Maduro, including Rodriguez, And because Maduro and the others did not appear in court, they were sentenced by they were condemned they were ruled against by default, and sentenced to pay $314 million in penalties or something like this. But Delcy Rodriguez actually sent a lawyer before the court saying that as president she should be immune, and then both the Trump administration and the State Department also issued letters telling the court that, you know, Washington recognizes her as president and it would be kind of prejudicial to our foreign policy if she were to be involved in any kind of civil action. And also Washington, the Treasury Department also dropped sanctions against Rodriguez. So it's pretty clear that they are, I mean,